Hello and welcome to Neon Ghost Ghost Hour, your pop culture podcast. My name is Benjamin Fiege and today I welcome one of the greatest female singer-songwriters there is, Cat Power. Cat Power, aka Shawn Marshall, is creating magical music moments with her folk blues sound since the mid-90s. Her latest work, in 2023, she paid tribute to Bob Dylan by recreating his concert in the Manchester Free Trade Hall from May 1966. The concert became infamous because Dylan discovered the rock musician within himself and went electric. We talked with Shawn Marshall about the album, the upcoming Germany concerts, her love to Bob Dylan, and creepy backstage visitors. So, sit back, enjoy the show, subscribe if you like what you hear, and recommend us to your friends and family, and if not, to your worst enemy.
Neon Ghosts. Ghost Hour. A pop culture podcast.
Hello?
Sorry, I had it on mute. Oh. Hello, how are you?
Hey, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Thank you, very well. Just relaxing with my dogs outside in the sun.
Oh,
yes.
Nice. Where are you? In the US or?
Yes, I live in Miami.
Oh, Miami. Not bad. Fits to my t-shirt. I'm just wearing a Miami Vice t-shirt. Yeah, Bob Dylan is the topic of your concert. You also have an album out. Why do you think Bob Dylan is regarded like as such a like almost holy figure for so many musicians?
He is the Mount Everest of our lifetime, of the teller of the tale, the storyteller, you know?
Do you remember when you first time got in touch with his music?
Yeah, I was five and heard Mr. Tambourine Man, and it felt like he was singing. The song sounded like a photograph of a dream. It sounded like something I could understand, as opposed to all the other music I was, all the other music that was around me at that time.
What other music was around you at that time? How stark was the contrast?
We lived with a funk band called Mother's Finest. My grandmother raised me till I was five, and when I was born till I was five, and the music that I had in her home was, you know, Johnny Cash, Patsy Cline, Bing Crosby, Ray Charles, Hank Williams, Elvis Presley, that kind of thing. And then when I met my parents and my stepfather and all of those people, it was like a big party. You know, we lived with a funk band at first called Mother's Finest. So there was a lot of, you know, funk music, you know, like, you know, Earth, Wind and Fire, just a lot of just amazing stuff. And then we lived at this, like, you know, rock and roll drug house. And that was like, you know, everything from the Allman Brothers, the Stones to, you know, and then we lived with this across from a fashion designer who was like Pat Kelly, who was like my father figure. And that's when my mom like became Ziggy Stardust. She called herself Ziggy for like 20 years after that. But and then from him, I learned about Donna Summer and like, you know, disco and like classic, like, soul music. And then, and then with my father, learned about, you know, some jazz and some blues. And it was a lot going on because everybody band, you know, back then in the 70s. You had kids, you just put them in a room together and everybody did drugs and like rocked out, you know, and you were lucky to like get food. So you learned a lot about music and sort of the identity that all of the, it was very different from growing up with my grandmother with, clean sheets and home cooked meals and bedtime and story time and classic like Patsy Cline, songs, Hank Williams and Willie Nelson and like sort of like this sort of elegance to music and songwriting and storytelling and then and church, So you learned a little bit about like traditional song structure. I did. And then when I met these other people, it was like Jimi Hendrix and Small Faces and the Kinks and like all that stuff they listened to that they would they were young, they partied. It was like a lifestyle. So in that lifestyle, sometimes there were some people that I really trusted in their music. Bob was one of those people. Billie Holiday was one of those people. Otis Redding. Some of the singers were really like touched me personally. Like, it wasn't all like, it wasn't all wild rock and roll,
I read in one of the interviews you gave recently that the music of Bob Dylan, it almost felt for you as he was your boyfriend at that time. Can you describe
What
that?
when I was older, Patti Smith told me the same thing the second time I met her. But it's a thing, right? When I was in after I think I was 19 when I saw Don't Look Back, Pennebaker movie about Bob, and I was just floored. I was it's like I had met the guy that I'd loved for so long, I'd already seen him two times by the time I was 20. And when I saw that documentary, it was like I watched it all the time. I had a bootleg, a copy of it, So he was a little older than me. He was 23, I think, in the documentary. And I was 20, 19, 20, and that's how I felt. I felt like I had a romantic notion, like if I could only have been alive in 65, 66, 67. I imagine that Bob was my boyfriend. Sometimes we imagine things when we're young because we don't have a boyfriend, we don't have a lover, we don't have love, and we feel very alone. And so we just like are a nerd just listening to music all the time and working a job to pay your bills. And you just imagine things, And
Did
that was that.
any other musician have that impact on you, or
No,
did you have to
there were
create with
there
someone?
was an Robert De Niro from Mean Streets that at the same time I had two Bobby D's in my life that like you if they were standing in the room with me and I had to choose one or the other, one was 1966, one was 1977, it I don't know what the fuck I would have done, I mean one's a Gemini, one's a Leo, I don't know what to do here. One's an athlete, an actor, Playboy. One's a like genius, Playboy. I don't know what to do.
Maybe one has to cross these guys somehow.
Yeah, like build, I, build, build, build a what is it? That's where we went with my imagination.
I mean, it's something very beautiful to be like a fan, and many people lose that over some time. Is it still possible as a professional musician that you are now yourself to stay a fan, or is that something you lose over time?
Of course, if I have a bad run-in with someone who I admire their work, I tend to not look at their work in the same way anymore because it affects me as an artist, because I feel like artists, if they can't communicate with openness with one another, it's not healthy, to communicate with them. So, and that means, looking at their art or reading their book or listening to their music. So, if I don't feel like they're a healthy, creative person, like if the consciousness is toxic, I stop. But I'll say it, Kanye, just period. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's the example there. But the as far as the romantic notion of like my heartstrings for Bob Dylan when I was, 17, when I heard To Ramona. That wasn't romantic love. That was, I felt when I heard, I got it for $1, $1.50, that another set of Bob Dylan record. When I heard To Ramona, I felt like there was no such thing as time. It was as if he was standing below my window, singing to me in real time about seeing me for who I am, protecting me, understanding the struggle of whatever I'd gone through, the story of what women, certain specific kinds of Southern women have gone through, something, there's something there. That song, oh, I already loved Bob Dylan already, but the freedom of thought, Idiot Wind, I was already at concerts, I loved him. But when I heard that, I hadn't had a romantic notion of him as an artist yet, as a soul, as a spirit. It gave me like armor. I felt seen. I'd never heard a song where a man spoke so protectively of a woman. Anyway, so then it's when I saw that documentary. That's when the romance began, when I was becoming a woman. I was 19, 20. I'd already, been on my own for some years and, just was doing my thing in poetry and music, not knowing what I'm doing, playing free jazz shitholes and loving, working five jobs, being out of the South and being. I didn't have friends and I was fine. I was taking care of myself. And Bob Dylan was like someone I would have loved to have met on the, would have been someone I would have loved to have met. And when I was 23, when I first went to London, I walked across the park there. I got to open up for him and Neil Young right before the pandemic in that park. I forgot the name, Hyde Park. But when I was 23, I was staying at the Columbia Hotel and I walked across the park and I saw the Royal Albert Hall and I stood there, I don't know, 45 minutes, like pretending like the scene when the girls are downstairs looking up, at the windows in the documentary, in the Pennebaker movie. I pretended that I was like, there was no one there and that Bob was coming out for a cigarette and then I gave him a cigarette. And he asked me to come in and watch the sound check. And then in my mind, it was like, oh, we were linked now. You know how they say like in quantum physics that if you have a conscious thought that there's a vein that lives, you know what I'm talking about? Dual reality or interdimensionality. Have you heard about that? Yeah. So in my mind, I went back to that. Hotel m many times after that trip, and I went back to that place. I drove by Royal Albert Hall for years. I've never stepped foot in it, but I will never forget standing outside, the door, and that imagination of Bob coming out with his curly hair, running out to buy cigarettes. But I had a full pack. So when I met him in 2008, I had a full pack. I already knew that he smoked Marlboros, so I was like, "I gotta smoke for you." Hand him the pack, and it's.
Did you tell him all these stories
No,
in that?
I told him I loved him and, I was older then. It was 2008, and I still love him, and I, it's not, it's like that romantic notion, is gone, but I still carry my 20-year-old self with me. I don't forget what she was like and how shy and, mixed up she was, I also remember the girl and the young woman in 2008 who was sober and really, getting stronger and, saw life in a different way for the first time in her life and chose to sing and put the instrument down. I don't forget my love for him then, it's not, we can have heroes, but when you meet them and you learn that they're human beings, it makes it much more sweet, if he had been a if he had been a dark soul to me, maybe that's I would carry pain from that meeting, and that would be sad. But I don't have sadness when I think about him. I have, I got to see him, right before I played that Royal Opera Hall show, and it was the, I've seen him maybe a little over 30, maybe 32 times since I'm 15. That show right before I did that Royal Opera Hall show, a couple of days before, that was the greatest I've ever heard his voice, and I can't explain that. I don't know the magic that he possesses, or the spiritual link he has with the universe, or the man upstairs, which he cited before. But I can tell you, I questioned reality when I heard how perfect his intonation, his vocal, the notes, it was perfect. And I've never ex I've seen him play a lot of different concerts, and I've heard his voice in different ways, and his musicianship and the band was perfect. Everything was perfect, and it was a gift. And that is unusual to see something. It was amazing to see him so perfect.
You mentioned the Royal Albert Hall show. That was your first time you played that venue, or did you had the chance before
That is
already?
correct. I had never stepped foot in there. And when I got the call, I couldn't get a show in the UK. I had five singles from the covers record on rotation at BBC, which is a huge, just tells you how much, England loves music, because they're all cover songs. And like, that's so cool, that they put these covers on the air. But I couldn't get a show. So that was, but anyway, I got one offer. Revolution Night, Bonfire Night, Guy Fawkes Day, November 5th. The question was, you got a show. Do you want it? It's November 5th at Royal Albert Hall. Do you want to do it? And I said, fuck yeah, but I want to play Dylan Goes Electric. And it was like silence. When silence is like, my whole adult, I think all the schools I went to as well, like being the new kid all the time, sometimes three different schools a year. My childhood was moving around a lot, which is, great experience, as like a, I wanted to be a painter and a poet. So I think that I didn't suffer. I just learned, that was my position. Kids adapt. But I think all that running around, I run on my gut instinct a lot. I'm in situations where I have to survive on my gut instinct. So my gut was like, fuck yeah, Revolution Night, Bonfire Night, Royal Albert Hall, Dylan Goes Electric, no brainer. And that complete silence, usually in my whole life, is met with, you're crazy. Oh, Sean, what are you talking about? But this time it was complete silent. Nobody was saying, you're crazy, or that's insane, which is usually how it goes. And it was nothing. It was just silence. And then it was, call you back. And then about a minute and a half, phone rings, you got it, it's done, and then call you later. And then I had this pain in my shoulders, and I felt like the weight of like the history of rock and roll on my shoulders, of like, what have you fucking done, you little kid, like what did you do now, like I'm in trouble, I'm going to be in trouble with so many people. And I was, a lot of journalists, like I just got off the phone with some great guy. Seems like a very knowledgeable, respectful man. But he said, I have to be honest. I went to that show at Royal Albert Hall, and as I sat there before you played, he said to me just now, he said, I thought to myself, how dare you? And that's the kind of thing that I was up, that's, but I'm not a kid. I can handle it. It's just a fucking interview. It's just a song. It's just a record. It's just an homage to Mount Everest, the greatest living songwriter of our lifetime, who's still bouncing around doing the most impeccable concert I've ever heard him sing before. Like, I don't care. You know what I mean?
So when you entered the stage there, did you feel that kind of pressure in that moment, or?
I have a great story. I've only told a couple people. Well, I won't tell it. I'll keep it. I'm gonna keep it. But anyway, it involves Jimi Hendrix. It basically involves Jimi Hendrix at rehearsals, and it involves Jimi Hendrix on stage when I walked out, but I won't mention what it is. But it felt like when I walked on stage that I was being welcomed, that I didn't just see like the audience. I saw like people from hundreds of years ago. I saw like almost like a, there were more than, you know, whatever it is, 3,000 people there. There were like more, there were a lot more people there than like the people that arrived brought people in their spirit, you know? That's how it felt. It felt like we were little kids, all of us. I don't care if the person in the front row was 82. It felt like every single one of us was on a little league baseball game and we just got to the pitcher's mound and we're all holding this bat. We're all holding the ball. We're all holding the catcher's mitt. We're all in outfield. We're all at second base. We're all running. We're all sliding in. The whole time it felt like we were all on the same team. It was pretty amazing. And I've never had that feeling before on a performance before.
Do you usually struggle with like stage fright or anxiety before going out? Or?
When I was younger, yeah, I had a couple incidences. When Moonpix came out in 98, I had a guy that was backstage in New York City at the Bowery Ballroom venue. And there was a lot of press that was invited by my ex-label. And he had a 9mm semi-automatic in his pants, and I had known him from North Carolina. He used to travel with Leonardo DiCaprio and Harmony Korine, and he was living with Kurt Cobain at the time. And he pulled the gun out, and I knew that junkies like Coca-Cola, so I pretended not to see the gun, and I said, "You want a Coca-Cola?" And I cracked the Coke, and I thought, when I crack it, he's going to blow my brains out. I handed him the Coke. He put the gun in his pocket, in his pants, took the Coke. I ran downstairs. I told the... So I've had people with guns at my shows, like psychotic people before. Mm-hmm. So when people say, oh, she's a train wreck and this and that, that's what they wrote that night when I saw him move through the audience. I told my record label when I ran downstairs. I told... You know, the people at the side of the stage were like, oh, she's crazy. She doesn't know what she's talking about. I told you that's what they do. And I said, fuck you. And I told the security guard, I said, call 911. There's a guy with the, I know he's loaded gun. He was living with Kurt. Kurt had just died like 4 years earlier. Anyway, long story short, I ran out on stage because he was coming down the hall. They threw him on the floor. They didn't believe he had a gun. I watched him the whole time. The fifth song, he was coming towards the front of the stage. I fell on the floor and ran off stage, you know, shaking and crying. And they just thought I was crazy. No, there was a fucking guy. And he went and shot his parent. 2 weeks later, he shot his parents in their head and himself. So that was the first time I've had like a shooter. I had another shooter in France, in Montpellier, another shooter, another gun in Montpellier. I had a kidnap attempt in Argentina in my hotel room in a window. I had to beat the guy up, shove him out the window. So when people say like, I have stage fright, it's something other than that. Yes, I'm sensitive. I'm an artist. You know, we are sensitive. We're, you know, friendly, but people are so used to taking advantage of friendly, kind people. So as a female, I have to protect myself, you know? So yes, if I know that something's not right, yeah, I might act funny, you know, but it's not to be an asshole. It's to protect my life, to protect people around me. You know what I'm saying? And nobody knows that story. Nobody.
What kind of strategies did you develop to deal with all of that? I can imagine it's like
prayer, going back. Prayer, praying to the mother universe, ancestral healing. I do this ancestral clearing thing with sometimes like shaman work. They have to be really like good people though, because there's some darkness that people like feed on your light. And there's like these light workers, there's vortex healing that's really amazing. Just trying to stay grounded. You know, there's different teas you can drink to stay focused and, you know, just positive projection and, you know, being aware of my environment, praying, you know, praying to the universe, you know, keeping joy, having joy be my number one constant from when I wake up, you know, making sure to see them when they're coming. Because a lot of people try to help and take care of other people because they see their pain and they see their struggle. It's learning when to say no. A lot of it is when learning to turn away and to say goodbye to toxic greed.
You mentioned Kurt Cobain earlier. Is it true that you had like a spot planned for that show with his wife, Courtney Love?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, that's just, I think I told a couple journalists that, but that is true. She said she couldn't come, and then I said, well, what if you yell out Jesus? And she said, oh, genius, I'll be there. But she didn't show up. It's difficult how persecuted she was, you understand? So I wouldn't want to go either. I don't blame her.
In your previous cover albums that you made, you more or less reinvented the songs and fit them your style.
Because I'm not an academic. I'm not proud to be one. It's just the case in point. I couldn't tell you a chord. I could try to tell you a chord, what it sounds like, but I can't. So that's why my cover songs sound the way they do. Because it's basically just loving the song so much and holding it in the way that I play. That's all. Holding space and just trying to spread some love and. Because I love the song. Sometimes I love the, most times when I love the song, it's because I love the singer and the song together. Sometimes that's the vital ingredient that hooks my spirit to their spirit, you know, in lineage of like a teacher in some way, a guide.
Did you try to make it different with the Bob Dylan songs to stay
No.
closer to
Yes.
the original, or is that something that just evolved?
No. I went to rehearsal to see what was what, to meet the players, and you know there were a couple songs that sounded like I was selling hot dogs on Beale Street, so we had to tone it down a little bit and make it more elegant and more had to make a couple more things a little more slower and more respected, because I feel like Bob didn't get to. You had to play it loud. It's like he created punk rock in that moment. And I think, I've had to always do that alone with my guitar. I've had to tell the guy, turn it up when the skinheads, in Knoxville are yelling, fuck you suck, and I was 22, 23. So if I hadn't seen that documentary of when he said that, I never would have had the balls to say, fucking turn it up, because I can't hear, because there are some hateful, ignorant people here tonight, and I think that I'm trying to answer your question. I'm sorry. I get like this when I do interviews, because it's emotional. I find, music is so healing and so powerful. It's the one place where we all meet and we'll never cross each other's paths, So it's important, in the name of Bob, I feel like it's important. So yeah, with the recording. That to decide to record it live was a big issue. It took me about 3 months to convince, the person that I work with, who's my manager. I never had a manager before. When my record label dropped me, I had just become a new mother, and I needed help in the entertainment industry because my career kind of collapsed. So, it took me about 3 months to convince him to try to help me get my new label, who I love, Domino, to come up with the money. It costs a lot of money to get a truck and fly. It's a lot of money. And they agreed. I thought the shit that was going on in America with canceling Black history in America, canceling abortion rights, banning books, banning actual literature, American literature. I thought, fuck, I should record this just to make a document, because maybe somewhere, someday, someone will listen to this, by chance, because I met a lot of people in my peer group who don't even know Bob's music. Whatever, it doesn't matter to me. But I had no idea that Timothy Chalamet was going to come out, Chalamet, and do his thing, for that movie, you know, that came out. And I tell you, my son, you know, having worked so hard on this tour, he doesn't want me to mention Bob Dylan. He knows who Bob Dylan is, you know. But when his best friends, who are 8 and 10, go see the movie, and both of his best friends both get acoustic guitars and electric guitars and harmonica set around the neck, and they're learning Bob Dylan songs, my son is like, I haven't seen the movie. My son is just like, I don't want to hear nothing about Bob. Little did I know that I was thinking college kids might get turned on to Bob Dylan songs if I do this record, you know, and learn about civil unrest, which we've civil rights movement has never ended in this country. But little did I know, Timothy Chalamet would bring Bob's music to 8 and 9 and 10 year old boys, like done, like victory, you know? That's huge. That's who you should be talking to.
Said that he didn't get an Oscar now for that, huh? Like he was really
He'll
good.
probably get a Grammy though for the album, I think, because it came out this year, I believe, or is coming out, you know.
I did not know that before. That the actual Royal Albert Hall concert of Bob Dylan did not even take place in that venue. It took part in it happened in Manchester.
Correct. We played there the night before and we recorded that show as well.
I just wanted to let that.
Nobody knows that. You're the only guy that kn You're the only journalist I've told.
I mean, the concert itself became famous because back then Dylan turned away from his folk roots and sparked some outrage from his fans.
Yeah, I mean, if I were in his shoes, which I never have been, but if I were there at that moment in time, I would have had some outrage and I would have gotten a fucking electric guitar and I would have fucking played it loud too, because shit was fucked up in America back then too, you know?
But is that something you also faced, or can you feel yourself into what he felt at that time? Like as an artist, you always want to develop, you want to make the next step. You also don't want to lose your old fan base that supported you. Did you also felt that dilemma once in your career? You wanted to do something, but it wouldn't have been in line which people expected from you?
You know, my ex label had told me to make a hit record, and I did. It came out top 10 on the Billboard charts. It was called Sun. But I developed, due to stress in my life, I developed an autoimmune disease I didn't know I was born with, and I was in intensive care. And the whole thing, the rug came out from under me. I worked really hard to tour it, to tour that record, and it just, you know, it's one of my favorite records I think I've ever done. Probably my favorite. It, the other, I just, the things that we're going through right now, in America, this is a reflection of how I felt then when I was recording it. That record, Sun, is like, I would, I. In a time capsule, I wish that I was releasing that right now, because that was how I felt back then. What we're dealing with internationally, that's how I felt back then. But times change, you know, you grow, you do something else, you keep going, you know, you don't look back.
Think nowadays it wouldn't have that impact when an artist changes his genre. Feel everything is more fluid nowadays. Do you think so as well, or do you see?
Well, I think we have big monopolies that instruct people what to think and how to behave, and I think that making sure that you sorry, making sure that I am my weakest link and greatest link at the same time. You know, nothing, I can't let anything get past me, because I'm so critical. I'm so self-critical of what I create, whether it's painting, writing, you know, cooking. It's just the way that I am. I'm working on that. I'm trying, you know, just to be more gentle with myself and to be more gentle with that. But I think that I've grown up, we've a lot of times I've figured out how to get around the rules since I'm little. And I think that that's how I've been able to live and thrive, on my own without help necessarily, or without anybody, without a witness. And I think when prayer, sometimes when I'm praying, to the universe, or to my soul or my older self or to my ancestors, or whispering to my son when he's sleeping, there's some parts that I know that I'll never be able to get right because there's nothing really truly right. And like Miles Davis said, you can learn from mistakes. The world is made for people to follow those rules, and the rules don't apply to everybody, the because the laws, quite simply because the laws don't apply to everybody, and people had still have to lose their lives to create laws. So I forgot what your question was, but I hope I answered it.
Yeah, to close the topic on the Dylan part, was there any feedback by the master himself for your album or?
You know what sucks about me is that I think I have ADHD, and because of whatever who I am, but I have a lot of information in my brain, but I forget a lot of information that I know that I'm going to do, and it falls in the cracks, and I have two hands, 10 fingers. I'm so blessed to have a voice and a tongue and my health to be able to do, and a job to be able to do all the things that I try to accomplish. But one of my things is I've been meaning to send Bob a care package since 2 years. I know where he lives. I know a couple of his people. And I feel like a lot of guilt with things that I don't remember to do, but I don't care if he likes it. I would love if he felt comfortable with it. I would love that if he felt. I would love if he accepted the. It's a lot. It's like I feel a lot, so, and I'm sure he does too, but I don't know what he thinks. You know what I mean?
Thank you.
And now a message from our sponsors.
The world talks about Africa, but when you want real insights, it crickets. That's why we built Raw Academy. Access in-depth insights from Africa's top entrepreneurs, investors, and industry leaders. Not just headlines, but real strategies, real opportunities. Discover high growth sectors, navigate emerging markets, and learn the nuances that drive success. At Raw, we give you the tools to make decisions that are smart, strategic, and profitable. From tech and startups to agriculture and energy, we connect you to Africa's most promising sectors. This isn't about charity, it's about opportunity. Business leaders, investors, and entrepreneurs, it's time to take action. Visit the Raw website at resources.raw.academy. Gain the knowledge, make the move, and own the future.